When you listen to your ambition, you can accomplish amazing things. Whether you're looking to start your career or get ahead in your career, your journey begins at Seneca Polytechnic's Open House on Saturday, April 20th. Join us in person or virtually from 9 a.m. to noon to discover programs, meet Seneca experts, attend live presentations, and explore our campuses. You've got the ambition. Now take the first step. Register at SenecaPolytechnic.ca.
Oh, man, did he make that look easy. Four touchdowns now on the day as well for the rookie Chase Claypool.
TSN 1200.
Well, not since the likes of, what, Jerome Paython back in the day? Remember him from the Colts days, amongst others? Have we had a Canadian receiver come into the National Football League and have the impact that Chase Claypool has had? And it's still early days. But Pittsburgh Steelers fans are super excited to see what they've got in the young Canadian receiver out of Notre Dame, who has, six touchdowns. Now, early on, including a four-touchdown game against the Eagles a couple of weeks ago. And Chase Claypool is leading the way in what looks like, well, I don't know if influx is the right word, but we've got more than a few Canadian wide receivers down playing U.S. college football right now who look like they're going to break into the big time and follow in his footsteps.
Yeah, no, it is pretty cool. Love the diversity. So many of the basketball players have followed that. And what's the running back? Is it at Oklahoma from Edmonton as well, JR? I mean, you're talking about some highly skilled, high-end players, not just a bunch of offensive linemen. So I think this is really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. So Dave Naylor has an article on TSN.ca, actually talked to some of these athletes and went back in time and spoke with Jerome Paython as well. And Jerome Paython was actually the second round pick in the same draft the Colts took Peyton Manning in the first round.
Okay.
So we're talking about the 1998 draft. So,
and he was drafted out of Acadia?
No, he went to Acadia and then transferred to the University of Washington.
Okay.
So he did play U.S. College ball, but he was really kind of the first big name Canadian receiver we saw make it in the National Football League. There have been a few. Tommy Kane, I don't know if you remember that name at all, had some time in the National Football League, but Chase Claypool has come in like the proverbial house on fire, and maybe we'll have a few more follow in their footsteps. So to the Gabriel Pizza Hotline we go, and we welcome Dave Naylor from TSN.ca joining us this morning. How you doing, Dave?
Very well. Pleased to join you guys.
Yeah, good to have you on again. This is really a really, really interesting story. And as you kind of did some research, you talked to Jerome Paython, and you talked to some of these young receivers. Is there a reason we're seeing all of a sudden all these Canadian receivers suddenly come to the fore playing U.S. college football?
Well, it's funny, you know, because I really have tracked sort of the development of football players from Canada into the NCAA and the NFL for 30 years. I mean, I remember in 1991, 92, covering, you know, Tyrone Williams from Western, who got drafted by the Arizona Cardinals and ended up winning a Super Bowl with the Dallas Cowboys. But since him, there have not been a lot. And by the way, Tyrone's final NFL stats, one catch for 25 yards. So, you know, he didn't have a glorious career, but hey, he's also the answer to the trivia question, the only human being who has a Vanier Cup ring, a Grey Cup ring, and a Super Bowl ring. So
nice.
That's not a bad trio to have. But since then, it's funny that it really hasn't happened very much. And I think one of the things is that, you know, if you're a high school player and you're an offensive or defensive lineman, let's say you're an offensive lineman and you're 6'5", you know, 270, and you can run and you've got great movement, even if you're not that developed as a football player, there's going to be a school that's going to take you. And you may not play till your third year, but there's just only so many human beings on the planet that have those dimensions that, you know, you can get into high-level football programs. With receivers, it's not so much. I mean, it's not a freakish body in most circumstances or measurables that make a receiver. Receivers kind of have to prove that they can play, that they can go up for the ball, they can win those battles, that they can run routes, all those kinds of things. So it's been a lot harder, you know, even for very good athletes to go from high school football in Canada, you know, to the big time in the NCAA. And that was Jerome Paython's experience, you know, coming out of high school in Vancouver. It was like nothing. And obviously this was a guy who was good enough to be a star in the NCAA and a pretty good NFL receiver, but coming out of high school in Canada, he couldn't get any takers. So if you look at the guys right now who are lighting it up in the NCAA, every one of them at some point, you know, left high school in Canada to go play in the U.S. And this is a real kind of, politically, it's a bit of a charged issue because, you know, Football Canada loves the fact they can point to these guys and say, look at what you can do playing football in Canada. growing up playing football in Canada. But at the same time, when you're skimming off the cream of the crop in high school and they're going to the U.S., it weakens the domestic product. But at the same time, you could look at a guy like, you know, John Metchie, the receiver at Alabama. If he had stayed in Canada, you know, how many corners are there in Canadian high school football that could match up with him? You know, it's just, you're just not going to get the same level of competition and coaching. So it's, that's a big part of it. And it, and you just got more athletic players going to the game. I mean, you look at the wave of Canadian basketball players that have come through the NCAA starting, you know, 15 years ago, you're starting to see the same thing with very athletic guys at the receiver position. And it just, you know, it's one of those things that you just start looking at and you start adding up and you say, like, there has never been, you know, a class of receivers like this. I mean, Chase Claypool is 22, you know, and you look at, and the Joe Joe is 18. If you look at the guys right now between those ages of 18 and 22, there's, I don't think there's ever been a comparable class. And Claypool is the one exception to what I mentioned about the high school thing. He did complete his high school in Abbotsford, B.C., went on the camp circuit where you go to colleges with, you know, dozens or hundreds of other kids and try to impress, and he certainly did to get his opportunity at Notre Dame. But he's really the trailblazer of this new wave.
And to that, Dave, hey, recruiters who watch you on tape, but they're watching Canadian high school. Assumption, most cases, as you pointed out, you're not getting a scholarship unless you go down and they can have a cross-section of playing against the best of the best in the United States as well, right?
Well, it's true, and it's still an issue. Another player, you know, he's not a receiver, but he's a skill guy, is Chuba Hubbard at Oklahoma State. And he's another guy who did it right from Canadian high school, did not go to the U.S. He finished his high school in Edmonton. And it was funny, you know, when I was down at Oklahoma State about this time last year, and I had an opportunity to interview Mike Gundy, the head coach there, and he said, he said, yeah, we weren't really sure what to make of his film because he wasn't playing against a whole bunch of athletes up there or something like that, right? And it was funny, one of the guys on the staff at Oklahoma State, when we were walking down the hall after a few tournaments, he goes, yeah, I kind of wish Coach Gundy hadn't quite described high school football in Canada that way.
he's usually politically correct in everything he says, right? Well,
exactly. You get a little taste of why Mike Gundy sometimes, you know, rubs people. And I, you know what, I said to him, look, he's not wrong, right? When he's comparing it to the elite levels of high school football, and even though there's pretty good high school football in Edmonton, I know the point he was making. But yeah, bluntness has been a Mike Gundy trait for a long time, but that is an issue, right? And I say, and I think, again, with Chuba, like Chuba was, I'm going to get this wrong, but like the fourth fastest under 18 in the world when he ran track, you know, for Canada. So, you know, a guy who, yeah, he hadn't played against the best talent in high school football, but he had a measurable quality that was world class. You know, there were only three guys in the world his age faster than him, you know. So you were, that's part of why he was able to make that leap, you know, to the Big 12 playing at Oklahoma State and lighting it up. But for a lot of guys, it's, unless you have that freakish measurable quality, you know, you're going to have to get in against the best competition. And as I say, all those receivers I mentioned, all, you know, different plays. John Metchie left at grade 9. You know, and he's an interesting guy. His three older brothers all played football. One of them, Royce, is the safety for the Calgary Stampeders. They all stay. I think one of them went out to Atlantic Canada, one of the conferences out there. But he was the youngest brother, and I believe he's the first one that, you know, his family said, okay, you know, you can go away to high school as a grade 9. He went to Maryland and then finished up in New Jersey. But obviously you see, I mean, when you see a Canadian as a sophomore starting at the University of Alabama, that's a heck of a player.
Dave Naylor from TSN.ca is joining us. Yeah, and you mentioned John Metchie's from Brampton. So is Josh Palmer, is a senior at Tennessee. Can you the minor football program in Ottawa, Dave, when it's up and running, unfortunately not running this year, but sure, is very, very strong. You spend a lot of time here.
Yep.
What is it like in the Toronto area? What is the the equivalent of how strong a minor football program we have here in Ottawa?
You know, I'll give you my opinion on this, but I'm by no means an expert. And you're right. I mean, it was funny, all those years that there was no CFL team in Ottawa, you know, I used to say to people, I said, you know, this still might be the best football town in the country, you know, when it comes to actually producing players. I'm not sure there's a better, you know, development system and more productive development system than there is in Ottawa. And in Toronto, I think it's a suburban game, right? And so you have things like in places like Mississauga, there's tons of good football players come out of Mississauga. In fact, I believe the Toronto Argonauts, if there had been a season this year, would have had three receivers from Mississauga. Mateo J being one of them, Juwan Breskison being another, and the third one, his name is going to escape me, but he's the one whose brother plays for the Raptors, so they took him in the draft this year. And all three guys, are Mississauga guys. Brampton is another area. And really, if you look at Brampton, I mean, you go across the league, there are guys, you know, Jerome Messam, an outstanding Canadian twice, is from Brampton. Shamari Williams, who was the number one pick of the draft about a decade ago, from Brampton. I believe Mike Adam, the safety in Saskatchewan, I believe he's a Brampton guy. I mean, Rob Maber, who was a punter forever for the Calgary Stampede. I mean, you just go across and look at guys from Brampton, and they say, you got, I mean, it's amazing when you think of this weekend. You got Tennessee, Alabama playing on Saturday. I mean, that's an SEC headline game. And you got two starting receivers, one on Tennessee, one in Alabama, who've known each other since Pee Wee football. Like that, we did a real fun thing this week. We got them together on a Skype call, and you can see that on TSN.ca. My interview with those two guys, and it was funny afterwards. I was looking at some of the quotes from the Josh Palmer when he was doing with the Tennessee media, and one of his quotes was, he said, "Yeah, I've known John like all my life. I just got off a Skype call with him, right?" And that was the one that I'd done with him because we thought it'd be really fun to get them together. I think it's more like, it's, I say, you know, where it's a suburban game, not necessarily a downtown game in terms of the players that I've seen produced. The high school game, it can be really strong in the city. But in terms of, like, the minor football development programs, those areas like Brampton and Mississauga really churn out players.
Dave, when we look at it, obviously level of competition, probably could even get into the rules. But really, when you look at the high school and collegiate football experience in the United States, it's going to be virtually impossible to keep any of these top kids, right? On every level, it would check the box that you got to head down south, or you want to head down south.
Well, and again, I think it's more important for certain positions, right? And if you look at Nathan Rourke, who was the starting quarterback at the University of Ohio for 3 years, he went down and finished his high school in the U.S. I'm trying to think of other guys that have played. I'm trying to remember what Brandon Bridge did, whether he went down and did that or not. I mean, I'm talking about quarterbacks now. It's amazing that Jesse Palmer didn't, you know, that he played, right, went from Myers Riders to, you know, starting games at the University of Florida. I think it's probably more important at certain positions than others. And I don't want to sound like I'm being disrespectful to Canadian high school football, but you know, the sport is just in terms of pure numbers, you know, that play the sport in the U.S. In a high school system where they pay their coaches. I mean, that's a job, right? So there's obviously, when you're paying people, there's going to be more accountability and more expected than when you're not. And you've got the numbers. It's funny. For all the time I've covered football, which is, you know, most of my life, I'd actually never been to a U.S. high school football game. My ex-wife is from Tennessee, and we went to her high school reunion, like, I don't know, this 20 years, 15 years ago or something like that. And I went to a game, and I realized I'd never been to a U.S. high school football game. And it was in suburban Memphis, and there were about, you know, 8,000 people there and two full marching bands. But the thing that really stood out to me was just how crisp the game was, you know, how fast, like when the ball was snapped, every player knew where to be, you know what I mean? And it was just kind of that crispness that you don't often see at that age, you know, did love some football in Canada. Hmm.
Tell everybody a little bit, because I'll be the first to acknowledge that Ajo at Clemson, who got his first touchdown last week. I mean, he's catching passes from Trevor Lawrence, who people acknowledge may be the best quarterback to come out of U.S. college football in a long time. He's 18 years old. His backstory is very interesting. So kind of fill everybody in on his story.
It is amazing. And I'm actually working on a story right now about Ajo. And to tell you, just to give you some perspective on it, yesterday I interviewed a professor at the University of Northern Michigan, who specializes in the impact of meatpacking plants on prairie towns and cities.
Okay. Wow, that's going deep, Dave.
That is going deep, okay? But just to tell you a little bit about his story. He's from Brooks, Alberta, which is a town about 200 kilometers, I think, southwest of or southeast of Calgary. Brooks, Alberta, 25 years ago, was a prairie town, like most prairie towns that you would experience driving across the country. They expanded, the meatpacking plant in that city expanded rapidly, kind of starting in the late 90s. and they had a great need for workers who came from all over the world to take those jobs, including a lot of them from Africa and the Sudan. The Joa Joe's family, he's from the Sudan, and his mother works in the plant in Brooks, Alberta. He's one of five kids. He was, a great basketball and basketball and football player just as a kid. Very ambitious, was dreaming of the big time from the time he, could understand what the big time was. He left at grade nine to go to high school in Edmonton, where he played for Brock Ralph, the former CFL receiver, was his head coach at Harry Ainlay High School in Edmonton. And then for his final year, he went to the Clearwater Academy down in Florida, where he got seen. He told me, got off the plane. There was, an offer basically from Indiana, one from Florida Atlantic. Played a little bit, got an offer from Alabama, got invited to Clemson's camp, and it was very quickly that he was recognized. He's a high jump record guy in Alberta. Was really on the fence about whether he was going to pursue basketball or football right to the very end of his high school days. And I mean, listening to Dabo Swinney, the head coach at Clemson, talk about him this week, and say, one thing he said really jumped out. He said, I've never really had a player like a Joe. I mean, Joe is 18 years old. He's 6'4", 220. You saw the highlight of his touchdown last week, but you see some of his moves, and he's still very gangly. He's still growing into his body. But it is a phenomenal story, how a Sudanese immigrant family come into a prairie town in Canada, raises a Clemson receiver, and raises that town, really helped raise that kid.
Yeah.
It's an amazing story when you see the number of people who recognize that, his mother with five kids coming from the Sudan probably wasn't going to be driving them in the minivan, three times a week to practice football practice, right? There's a lot of people in that community that stepped up and have really helped this kid as a human being and a football player. And I mean, he's just a freshman. I am so excited to see what this kid is going to do. And you just know at this point in time, when you're going to Clemson to play receiver in 2020, you got some talent. You got some potential.
Yeah, absolutely. Boy, and you think about it. I mean, the four names that you've mentioned, starting with Chase Claypool, obviously going to Notre Dame, and you got Josh Palmer at Tennessee, John Metchie at Alabama, now a JoJo at Clemson. This is not Southwest Eastern Louisiana Tech we're talking about. These are four elite programs that these kids are not only going to, but playing, starting in these places.
Terrell Janna at Virginia, another ACC school. Jarrett Wayne at Pittsburgh, another ACC school. He's just a sophomore. I mean, it really does remind me a lot of, and again, we've seen kids at other positions, but we're not used to seeing Canadians hold the ball. We're used to seeing them block and tackle.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
And putting their hands on the football. But it really does remind me of the wave that we saw come, in NCAA basketball 10, 15 years ago, where you're just like, oh, there's a guy here, there's a guy here. And all of a sudden, you couldn't keep track of how many there were. And that's kind of seems what's happening, at least in the receiver position. And and a lot of this is just, it's all happening at the same time.
Yep.
Chase Claypool exploding in the NFL and these guys doing all these things behind him in college. It's exciting that we have something Canadian and football to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. When's your Joe story going to come out? Do you know?
It'll be probably still a couple of weeks away.
Gotcha.
Yeah,
okay.
It's a major dig into what I think is just a fantastic story.
Absolutely. Look forward to watching and reading about that and watching these guys on our television screens tomorrow. Should be a big day for Canadian football down south. Appreciate the time as always, Dave. Thanks for the time.
My pleasure, guys. Thank you.
All right. There's Dave Naylor from TSN, tsn.ca on the Gabriel Pizza Hotline, brought to you by Pizza Perks at Gabriel Pizza. Download the Gabriel Pizza Perks app and sign up today. So, yeah, you're going to watch some SEC football tomorrow. Tennessee versus Alabama. Josh Palmer and John Metchie, two receivers from Canada, will be front and center.
No, pretty cool. And mentions Brooks, Alberta. That was where my buddy Greg Hamry's son Nick played with Cale McCarr. They got a real nice program. But you have touched on the diversity and the type of immigrants that are coming to Canada now is having a big effect on what sports are being driven towards. And we saw that with basketball. Now we're seeing it in football. And again, when you talk about Clemson, these schools, JR, like this is literally like a kid from Fort Lauderdale rolling into the Ontario Hockey League and being the leading scorer. it takes some convincing. And I didn't realize they had, I guess I kind of knew they had these pro days. For a lot of kids looking around, would not know anything about Canada, and for Clemson, like, that's awesome. And the experience. I mean, hey, the experience in any of these programs, whether it be high school or football, we just can't duplicate that here in Canada.
No, and the other part for me at least is it gives me, you know, and listen, I've got my kind of favorite teams in U.S. college football, but I don't have a huge, you know, I didn't go to any school or like that. So it's when I turn these games on, these high-profile games, it's nice to have a rooting interest, right? Oh, well, that guy's from Canada, so you pay extra attention.
No, you totally do it. And for mine, I was laughing because it was a shock back in the day when I believe your Eagles drafted Mike Shad out of Queen's University.
That's right.
And it was just like, it was so out of the blue, right? And that's a specialized position. He was basically a snapper, was he not? You know, and that's it.
He's drafted as a guard.
Was he a guard? Okay. Yeah, but as he said, to have these guys now that are playing the skill positions at big-time places and... when you're not only playing the NFL, but you're playing for the Steelers and being successful, that's big time as well.
Well, and we'll see if Chuba Hubbard ends up winning the Heisman, right? I don't know that the start to a season has been quite up to expectations, but still some racetrack ahead. So lots of Canadians doing great things down south. Totally. All right, 9:28, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll do This Day in Sports History and celebrate some sports birthdays, get you set for a busy sports weekend ahead, which will include the World Series, huge day of NFL football coming up on Sunday, and much more. That's when we return here on TSN 1200. It's another chance for you between 10 and 2 today, and then Ian and Lee, 2 opportunities this afternoon between 2 and 6. Don't forget, World Series Baseball is on all 3 nights this weekend. If you're looking to keep yourself busy, Rays and Dodgers will play Game 3 tonight, Game 4 tomorrow, Game 5 on Sunday. Also coming up this weekend is the big MMA match. We got Khabib versus Justin Gaethje.
Khabib, what's his last name?
Putin.
Nurmagomedov.
No,
don't, because now you're going to screw me up. Khabib Nurmagomedov.
Khabib. That's why we go with Khabib. It's just easier.
Exactly.
Last name or our first name first and last or whatever.
All right. So this, and again, I'm not an MMA guy. Yeah. Simmer's not an MMA guy. You're the MMA guy on the show.
Yes.
This would be in terms of...
we've had a couple of big main events because we just had Israel Adesanya and Paulo Costa. For the middleweight, and they were both undefeated.
Okay.
So if we're going to say which these two are on par with each other here. But Nurmagomedov, of course, I would say he's the biggest draw right now for UFC. He hasn't fought in a while. He hasn't fought since he destroyed Poirier. But now he's up against Justin Gaethje, who is coming off a couple of big wins and came off a massive win against Tony Ferguson, which has given him this title fight. Well, they both have titles.
Yeah, and I'm not a huge fan, and enough of the Roy McGregor, or whatever his first name is.
Yeah, Connor.
Connor. I'm just kind of sick of that, whatever. Move aside. This guy legitimately, JR, there is a hype and excitement. I've been watching some of the pressers. The other fella looks nervous, and the Ruski, there's a feel to this
the
guy.
The Ruski looks nervous?
No, he doesn't at all.
Yeah.
But he just, you know, you say whatever you want. I feel almost a little bit of Mike Tyson. Like, there's just this, hey, man, yeah, you can keep talking all you want, and this would be one of the few I'd be drawn in. And I also, he's a little more of a wrestler than necessarily a thrower, isn't he, Hammer? Or am I off on
that? No, you're absolutely correct.
And that's the part I do like. I like the actual jiu-jitsu part of it, when you get into that versus when they just start, you know, standing back and throwing them, and the freaking blood is everywhere, including on the crowd. I don't like that. So, no, I might watch this one.
And Khabib is not a boring wrestler.
What's with
this? First
of
all, you're not going to pay for it. Secondly,
yes,
you're not going to be up that late. And don't have any interest. I'm talking to Simmer. You don't have any interest, so don't
Come
give
on,
me any
man.
Of this.
Okay.
Yeah, I might watch that.
Well, not a late fight.
If I said I was going to watch the baseball, then I'm completely lying. But I just this hype of this going into it, this is going to be a good one.
The main card, they've changed it up for this one. The main card actually starts at 2 p.m. because it's in Abu Dhabi. Yeah, it starts at 2 p.m. our time, local time.
I thought the Fight Island ones, they still did in late at night.
They have, but Dana White decided, you know what? it's time to treat the locals a little bit here and not have these fights at 2 and 3 a.m.
And you know what you're able to do now, Hammer, too, is that, okay, when I go to a big prize fight and I've paid to go, if the prize fight is first, what do you think the chance of anyone sticking around? It doesn't
Well, the prize
matter.
Fight is not first, but yeah.
No, but my point, I've already got your cash. I don't care if you stay on and watch anymore. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is what you're able to do, where you would never do that if it was an event with a crowd.
So people are watching that. What time is the main
so
event
the main
be on?
Card, like so the main
o'clock?
Event will be, no, maybe 5.
5 o'clock in the afternoon tomorrow.
Yeah, 5 o'clock in the afternoon here, local time.
Are people aware of that? Are MMA fans aware of that?
I should certainly hope so. If they're not, hey, then I'll let you know that it's during the afternoon.
It'll be a little midnight in Moscow, Hammer.
Yes. So it's going to be perfect for them. They're going to have it for the regular time, and for us, it's going to be during the day. So it's not too bad.
Okay.
So we're going to wheel the TV. Like I said, we're going to have a little social gathering, distant gathering outside.
Is that why this is planned around that
as well? So the TV's going to go right up against the glass, and we can enjoy some bevies
around the
fire
and watch. You're going
to
subject minors to this?
No, kids. You can't have the kids come over.
Oh, okay.
Because they're just going to bug because they're going to be outside the entire time. No, this is adults only, 18 plus. But it should be a great fight.
Will your wife watch with you?
She does, but she tends to, when it's just her and I, she's on her phone.
I've heard of those 18 and over parties in Barhaven, but I never thought it was MMA.
The garage door will be shut. All right. No reason to think there's anything untoward going on.
All right. So we got World Series. We got a big MMA day tomorrow, and we got NFL Sunday, of course. We got triple header for you. We got the game of the day, which is actually the early game. Steelers-Titans should be a great game. 1 o'clock. Then we'll have the Niners-Patriots game, which is, it's a 3-3 team against a 2-3 team. I think the loser of that game may be in some difficulty regarding the playoffs. So that's a huge game. And then the night game, don't forget, got flexed in as the Cardinals and the Seahawks. We saw how good Arizona was last Monday night against the Dallas Cowboys. They're right back in primetime against Russell Wilson and the rested Seattle Seahawks. That's the new Sunday night game because the Vegas Raiders got flexed out because they've got a COVID outbreak on the team, which has wiped out their offensive line for now. We'll see if any or all of those guys can come back and play. But if it spreads, now the NFL is in a position where they can just postpone that game because it's been moved to the afternoon and they still have a game to show in prime time.
Yeah, and what a start the Steelers have had. Titans, a nice story. And for my Pats, assumption is they're going to have to win the division, JR, right, to make it. And for the 49ers, as you said, either of these teams lose, they're in some trouble because San Francisco, is that the best division in football?
Oh, not even close.
Yeah.
I mean, well, they're right now, record-wise, the worst team in the division, and they're 3-3. Now, this will be the first year, possibly, and I don't know if the math works on this or not because we're going to have 3 wild card teams, given the fact that they all have to play each other, so there will be a winner and a loser. But could you imagine if the NFC was strong enough where all 3 wild card teams ended up coming out of that division as well? Right?
Yeah,
you have the division winner. I don't know if it's even possible.
Yeah.
I guess if everybody beats each other once, then maybe. And then obviously all four teams win the majority of their teams out of division, but that would be something. But that goes to show you, yeah, absolutely. I don't think it's even close. I would say right now the AFC North with the Steelers and the Ravens is very strong. The Brownies have been beaten badly a couple of times. I think they're better.
Cincinnati's been a pleasant
surprise. I thought would be good. They've been up and down. They're okay, but not nearly as strong as the NFC West.
Yeah.
That's the best division of
football. And you, again, and we talked or started the show off on being on the quarterback carousel. That's probably where you're trending in. Is it year 5 for Baker Mayfield? Would that be? You said Carson Wentz. What's Mayfield, about year 3?
Yes,
you know,
3 or 4.
As to whether, where the hell that program's going, right? It's just the ups and downs. And the other thing, don't track it all the time because there was so much hype going into the Steelers versus them. And I think my good friend Teddy Bruschi actually picked the Browns. It feels like every time that they faced any type of pressure, they have just been absolutely terrible.
Yep.
And Baker Mayfield, under pressure, has been equally terrible in almost every game.
They're 4-2. The 2 losses were against the Ravens and the Steelers, and they got smoked in both of those games, not even close. And can I bring – I went on my rant with the Eagles, and I know most people don't care, in the first hour, okay, even though they won the game. But last night, again, they drafted Jalen Hurts in the second round. They're bringing in this package of plays where he comes in a quarterback and they flex Wentz out to the side. This is what the Saints do with Taysom Hill and Drew Brees. Can NFL coaches just stop with that garbage? It doesn't work if the guy who's coming in as never throws a pass. Every defense, first of all, you're playing 10 on 11 because he's never going to throw it to the quarterback who's flexed out. So we know he's basically, you can leave him alone. So you're playing 11 against 10 defensively. And then the guy always, like Taysom Hill, does he ever pass the ball? No, he just runs it. Oh, occasionally he'll hand it off. Like, it's the most idiotic. If you did it once in a blue moon, fine. I'm good with it. It's a change of pace.
Should be a
trying
wrench for
to
that,
jam eh? This in 10 to 15 plays a game. It doesn't work.
Isn't it just going to be a decoy for
it's,
down the road, though?
It's just
and then finally, boom.
It's just asinine.
Nope.
Yeah. I think we got to start working hammer here. The great JR. Get Phil Sims out of there and just slide a little JR right over there with Coach Cower. Hey, dress you up.
That'd make a lot of people happy. Yeah. You can get Phil Sims out.
Let's do this day in sports history. I'll get off my rant. It's Friday. I want to feel good going into the weekend. On this day, October 23rd, 1945, Jackie Robinson signed to play with the Montreal Royals. Of course, Jackie Robinson, who broke the color barrier in Major League Baseball in 1947, began his professional career playing in Canada.
You know what? And one of the things makes you proud as a Canadian, I'm not going to pretend for a second that we don't have racism and issues like every country, but at least at that time, if you watch his documentary, JR, one of the most refreshing things was his wife going to look for a house in Montreal. And how the lady rang the bell and went in and had tea, how they felt about their experience in Montreal and the way they were treated overall. I mean, it had to be absolute night and day. Even a restriction on some of the neighborhoods you could live in the United States, right? So I always that always made me real proud. And you had a lot of ball players. Was it Tommy Lasorda came through as a player as well? Like, there were a lot of guys that came through Montreal at that time.
Right. On this day in 1971, this is the time of year, right, when NHL seasons were beginning and first NHL goals. Guy Lafleur scored his first NHL goal on this day in 1979 against the Los Angeles Kings, against a attendee by the name of Gary Edwards. Are you familiar with Gary Edwards of the Los Angeles Kings?
Yeah, no, I remember that because I think Suitcase Smitty would have been around that. You said 71, then you said 79. Yeah, 71.
Sorry, 71.
Imagine at the time the hype that would have been for Guy Lafleur, right, coming out of Quebec Ramparts. The pick, and we always look at it exciting. I mean, you go back and watch the Rocket Richard movie, and the pressure that was on them as a family, like as a local player. So, that was my idol, along with Ken Dryden growing up. So, would have been a nice little flow. Wasn't the receding hairline, although he has more hair now than he used to have. But always fun watching Guy Lafleur, and hopefully can recover from lung cancer again.
Absolutely. On this day in 1983, Rich Sutter scored a goal, making the Sutters the first family in NHL history to have six brothers score a goal. His goal came in the third period of an 8-5 win over the Toronto Maple Leafs at the old Spectrum. Mm. By the way, exactly 25 years later, to the same day, this very day, Brandon Sutter, who is the nephew of Rich Sutter, scored his first NHL goal for the Carolina Hurricanes.
And we're going Brian, Daryl, Dwayne, and Brent, who are actually good hockey players, and then we'll put Richie and Ron into a different category.
The two twins. I thought Ron Sutter was, they were both decent. Sutter was a pretty decent player, wasn't he?
He
was the one who played with the Flyers, right? The other was drafted by the Penguins?
Yeah, extremely moody. I do know that, but they ended up being first-round picks, didn't they? For the Hamley. Who are you going to say best all time? Would you go with Brent?
Yes. He was the one that played for the Islanders,
right? Exactly. Went to Chicago at the end. My favorite by far was Brian. Ran into him and Pat Burns in Quebec at the draft in 1993 and had a few pints. He is one of those people that walks into a room, makes you feel like you are the best person on the planet. Like, what a man's man. What a good guy.
All right, we already went through the fact that this is the 27th anniversary of Joe Carter's three-run homer to win the Blue Jays their second consecutive championship in beating the Phillies 8-6. Mitch Wild Thing Williams, who will forget that name.
Oh, man. And you just, again, at least in kind of watching him, that's why he called Wild Thing. That pitch, I'm assuming, was down and in?
It was a golf shot by Joe Carter. Yeah. And it didn't really clear the outfield fence by a whole heck of a lot either.
But he had been getting tuned the whole series, did he not, Wild Thing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had they pitched him too much. He was done. And he wasn't very good.
And as I forget names all the time, I had brought up a pitcher for you that I watched with the Orioles when he first broke in that threw real hard. Didn't realize he went on to play that long because he had arm trouble. It was Greg Olson. Do you remember him?
Yes.
Had that really hard slider,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Number 30, I want to say.
Nice.
There you go. On this day in 1998, Mark Messier became the 10th NHLer to score 600 NHL goals. while playing for the Vancouver Canucks. Would that be the only thing of note Mark Messier did when he played for Vancouver?
Yeah.
That was not a good three seasons.
Yeah, like I told you, though, when George McPhee took over as general manager, we wanted to make a splash. And Mark Messier had a son that lived in Northern Virginia, a girl that he had never married or whatever. So he actually came to town with his dad. We went out and had pints with him in Georgetown, ended up offering him, I think, 3 years, JR, about $18 million.
Which was what he signed for in Vancouver,
well,
right?
Yeah, I think he got a tad more, but I remember, oh, man, I just think back, oh, thank God that didn't happen. That was just...
you would have got fired sooner.
Oh, the following year, we doubled down on Robert Lang, as I told you that story.
Good choice, good choice. On this day in 2002... I'm going to give you, so baseball's most memorable moment. This was probably, I'm guessing, during the World Series unveiled on Fox. They asked baseball fans, what is the most memorable moment in baseball history? I'm going to give you five, the top five.
Like regular season and playoffs?
Yeah, everything. Just the greatest moments.
Okay.
And you tell me what for you, and then I'll tell you the order that it actually came out. So... Lou Gehrig's farewell speech.
Okay.
That one. Okay. Mark McGwire breaking Roger Maris's home run record.
Yeah.
Hank Aaron's homer number 715 to pass Babe Ruth. Cal Ripken breaking Lou Gehrig's consecutive game streak in 1995. And Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier. Those were the five greatest moments. Yeah. In baseball history, which one do you think was, I won't ask you to rank them, which one do you think was voted number one by the fans?
I'm not a fan of the McGwire one just because of whatever the Peds going involved in that. Breaking the color barrier, my personal favorite, just because I was living in Maryland at the time, I'll go with Cal Ripken, but I'm going to guess it's not, but that would be my favorite
joke. That was the one?
Really?
You're absolutely right.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I wouldn't vote for that only because... Listen, it's a great accomplishment.
Well, not like breaking the color barrier.
Showing up for work every day is a great accomplishment. Don't get me wrong; people phone in sick all the time. I get that, but that's just not that. That's just not a moment for me.
Yeah. I mean,
hey, you showed up for work again today. Way to go! Wow, what a moment! Do you remember where you were when Cal Ripken came up in the first inning to make it official that he set the new record?
Yeah, no. Well, and the part for him was. For a bigger guy, what about 6'3", to play shortstop, the majority of that. And he also had Billy Ripken, and of course Cal Ripken Sr., the Ripken way, as they were known. And I'm going to go just sideways real quickly, JR. Back in the day in the OHL, it was the Hamilton Steelhawks. Bill LaForge is a coach. They're having tryouts, and he had cut a fella. And the fella the next day came and ended up dressing in the stands and was wheeling around the ice. And Bill LaForge comes over to the assistant coach and says, I thought we cut that guy yesterday. And he goes up to him, and of course he says, yeah, you did, but I want to go. Well, what do you think Bill does? He keeps him on the team.
Oh, so,
carry on.
There you go. On this day in 2008, Joe Sakic scored the 625th and final goal of his NHL career.
Wow.
I don't have him. Why did Joe Sakic retire in the middle of October?
That's a really good question.
I don't remember his career coming to an end.
No, I don't either. I always think about Don Baisley, the longtime agent. Think about Joe Sakic when the Washington Capitals, of course, traded for Dale Hunter and Clip Malarchuk. What went back was a couple of players and a first-round pick, and that first-round pick ended up being Joe Sakic. So, what a career. And,
best wrist shot in NHL history?
Ooh.
Pretty darn close.
Yeah, he would be for sure. I strangely on his own team when you had Hayduke and Forsberg, I always felt like Paul Kariya, but that was probably more the backhand. But there's been some great ones. And of the years I scouted, I'm actually going to give it – I'll put two guys ahead of it, JR. One would be Solane, and then the other one would have been Alexander Mogilny.
Okay, so differentiate right between wrist and snap. Right?
Yeah.
I'm drawing a difference between
the two. That's a good point. Okay. Well, let's go with it then.
All right. On this day in 2015, the run of the Toronto Blue Jays in the playoffs came to an end as they dropped a Game 6 decision to the Kansas City Royals by a score of 4-3. The winning run scored in the bottom of the eighth inning when Lorenzo Cain raced home from first base on a single. Hammer, I asked you, I had fuzzy memories of a hit to right field. But how did a guy score from first base on a single?
So it was Bautista. It was right along the line. He ran, and he just lobbed it to second base instead of gunning it down the first base line to try to keep that runner at third. So as soon as that rainbow was going into second, third base coach just
Cain kept going.
Said, see it? Get going.
Because that's amazing.
Scored easily. He was burning rubber, too.
So if Bautista had a thrown, because Bautista's got a great arm, if he had a thrown a bullet to second, then maybe he doesn't get sent.
His momentum was taking him away from second base as well. So if he just stopped and set his feet and gunned it, maybe he had a better chance.
Is that another one of the times where he was doing his hot yoga in right field?
got to stretch.
Nobody did. And actually, he kept himself in great shape that way, but that was always fun to see what he was doing.
Born on this day in 1869, this October the 23rd, John Heisman, former football coach who legalized the forward pass in the game of football. Okay. And for whom, of course, the Heisman Trophy is named.
And is that the whole rationale for the name of the trophy, JR?
I'm guessing that's
what
made
it
famous.
And that is held at the New York Athletic Club,
correct?
Right? And if you want to say stuffy. Been to Princeton University many times, and they have a nice display there for Hobie Baker, who I think was killed in World War II. And the trophy is actually there. But, boy, I don't think outside of team trophies... is there a more well-known individual trophy in the United States at any level, professional or amateur, than the Heisman Trophy? Like what would even come close?
Yeah.
Like, well, you know, I mean,
no,
I don't even know the name of, you know, any of the trophies in the National Football League for MVP. That you know, you're linked to absolute greatness when you win the Heisman Trophy in the United States.
Born on this day in 1935, Puerto Rican golfer, is it Chichi Rodriguez?
Turning to sports. Winner of this week's Gulf Coast Golf Classic was Chai Chai Rodriguez. Chai Chai finished with a 9 under par score.
Chichi Rodriguez.
Hopefully, Mr. Rodriguez will play up to par in his next competition.
That's a classic old WKRP skit. And now I swear, every time I see the name Rodriguez, I always go Alex Rodriguez.
Most famous for, other than being a good golfer, he always did the sword thing, did he?
That's
not?
Right.
And also, too, I saw a clip. I don't know what a tournament it was or what the hell was going on. Gary Player, who would be in around the same age, was playing JR. Has that guy ever aged or
no,
look any different?
The Black Knight.
Oh,
looks
man.
Outstanding.
He really does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's always there for the opening shots. I guess he'll be there at the Masters this year.
Yeah.
And it looks like he just hammers it out there still at however old he is.
A little different temperature, so to get lubed up is going to be a little tougher for these older guys.
Born on this day in 1940, so turning the ripe old age of 80 is Pelé, born in Brazil. 1,281 goals in 1,363 career games for Pelé over various national and club teams.
Yeah, and funny going back to, and again, another documentary I watched, him being, I think, a 16 or 17-year-old when he played in the first World Cup.
17.
And they philosophically changed the whole way they were going to play, where it is now known as the Brazilian way, right? Just get out and play. I wonder financially as well, JR, because he came over, and was he with the Cosmos, or where? Who did he end up playing with?
Yeah,
in
I think
MS?
So. Think
like
so.
The Franz Beckenbauer and a bunch of the names at the time probably end up making more money playing in some real bad MLS than he ever made playing anywhere else.
Yeah, who doesn't enjoy a good Brazilian? Born on this day in 1962, Doug Flutie. Of course, speaking of the Heisman, won the Heisman Trophy in 1984. With Boston College, you may remember this highlight when he was playing for BC versus Miami.
Three wide receivers out to the right. Flutie flushed. Throws it down. Caught by Boston College. I don't believe it. Oh. It's a touchdown. The Eagles win it.
Unbelievable.
I don't believe it. Phelan is at the bottom of that pile.
Wow.
Whoa. There you go. Doug Flutie to Gerald Phelan for Boston College in 1984. It became known as the Miami Miracle. Certainly elevated Doug Flutie to heights that he never would have seen coming.
No.
And, of course, went on to a very good professional career, including a four-time Grey Cup MVP. Three-time.
And at that time, JR, we're talking about the University of Miami, right? I mean, you're knocking off the premier program. You got a northern school. There's Brent Musburger doing it. And, what was also interesting with Doug Flutie, at least talking to some NFL people, as he would come to town. When he was starting in the CFL, that was fine. When he come in as the backup quarterback, he got so much publicity and so much love to want to put him in. There was like, listen, we got to get rid of this guy. He is way too popular with the fans.
There you go. All right. If you're celebrating a birthday today, happy birthday to you this October the 23rd or at some point this weekend. And with that, we will put a wrap on the show.